You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network.
I'm Ruthie Fierberg, and this is Why We Theater, the podcast that digs into the onstage works we love to make the offstage change we need. After all, that is Why We Theater. Today, we welcome playwright and actor Domenica Ferreau alongside experts Joanna Kendell and Dr. May Lynn Reyes Rodriguez to discuss Domenica's beautiful play, Rinse Repeat. The play premiered off-Broadway in 2019 at the Signature Theater Center. The story centers on Rachel, a Latinx college student battling an eating disorder, and her family, including her white architect father, Peter, her adopted Latino brother, teenage Brody, and her Latina lawyer mother, Joan, who also struggles with a less easily identified eating disorder of her own. The play begins when Rachel comes home for a trial weekend with her family after having spent months at an inpatient treatment center for her eating disorder. This episode does contain a lot of talk around eating disorders, their triggers, and their treatment, but we do our best to be gentle about all of it. For anyone who is sensitive to this content, I hope you will listen and take breaks when you need to and have a grounding plan in place. And now, rinse, repeat. Domenica, I am so excited to have you here. As you know, when I first read the play in 2019, it really just hit me like a ton of bricks in a good way. It was a story that I hadn't seen before, certainly not on stage. And certainly, you know, I find it so telling that in the script you say that the stage directions are important because it so much is happening non-verbally here. When we spoke in 2019, you told me that you had always intended to be an actor and only an actor, but that in studying acting, you were going to all these shows constantly. You never saw a show about eating disorders. And that when we do see stories about eating disorders in film or television, they're often, you know, a blip in a storyline, or they're criticized for being irresponsible because they're kind of glorifying eating disorders, or they're triggering people who have it, or they're just being kind of cliche. So how did you go about writing a story both responsibly and authentically?
Firstly, thank you so much for saying that. I really enjoyed getting to talk in 2019, and I'm so glad that that you were able to have that experience watching the play. And that is a really great question. The story of Rinse Repeat is not what happened to me, but it did start that way. It did start off as my life, and then it morphed. And I definitely have a very personal experience with eating disorders on several fronts, and I don't claim to be completely recovered. I'm not. It's something that's a part of my life, and I work on it every day to the best of my ability. And something I have known to be true is that, and I think this is the case with many addictions. Unfortunately, in society, we don't really consider eating disorder as an addiction. A lot of people see it as a choice, which is really frustrating. Right. And I've come to understand, you know, an addiction is never actually the problem. It's often like we think it's a solution to whatever's going on. There's something deeper. There's a lot of deeper stuff happening that the addiction is masking. For me, that was the experience of, you know, okay, this eating disorder on the surface seems to be like, that's what's really going on. If you just fix the eating disorder, everything's fine. But just fixing it it's a lot more complicated because there's all of these things that have come to a head and caused this problem to occur in the first place. And I felt like, okay, if I'm gonna look at this responsibly, I can't just take a superficial look. What I really wanted to show with this particular play was that this family has an illness and it's landing in the body of this girl, which is a very common experience. And there is a lot, I wanted to really explore all of the triggers that are going on, not just for Rachel, the person who we think is suffering, the only person suffering from the eating disorder, but also for her mother, Joan, and how this is a cycle, because that's been at least my experience and one I've seen often, there is a cyclical nature to this. I think I've struggled with looking at, you know, there's talk of an eating disorder as it's anorexia, it's bulimia, it's binge eating disorder. And I think there's this like glorification a little bit of like clean eating, because eating disorders are something that we profit off of as a society. I mean, I have thought a lot about why don't we want to talk about this? And it's like, well, how much money is made off the diet industry? Because it is the most successful failed industry in the world. And how much money is made off of making women hate themselves and, you know, really, truly.
Yeah, the beauty industry, the fitness industry, diet culture, all of 100%. It. Absolutely.
And then also, like, if we look at just film and television, the way that actresses look, what is representation? I mean, if the industry is really going to talk about eating disorders, well, then we'd have to look at the fact that probably a lot of women are having to go to crazy extremes to maintain a look that is just not achievable for the average person. Right. And we're showing that as like the norm. So I've often thought about, okay, well, why don't we want to unpack this? Why don't we want to talk about this? And because I felt like this wasn't happening often, I did want to do it in a way that felt safe for the audience, that they felt identified in some way, even if they themselves didn't suffer with an eating disorder, so that people also understand, because there is a lot of stigma surrounding this. Like, okay, well, I may not know what it is to have an eating disorder, but I do know what it is to not be accepted by my parents. And I know what I would do to make that happen, be it if I'm struggling with my sexuality, or if I'm struggling with another form of addiction, or if I'm, you know, like the character of Rachel wants to do something other than what her mother wants for her career-wise, like simple things that any person can identify with. And with Rachel, it's because of all of the elements of her life, it caused this life-threatening thing to happen. You can't just isolate the thing and be like, point the finger and say, you're sick, you're bad, you're doing something, you just need to eat. It's that simple. That's something that I've heard too much in my life, and I've heard parroted a lot. And it's just either that or you look amazing. You've never looked better. I mean, that's very common, especially in Latin America. I found, you know, when I went home, it was just like, oh my God, you know, I didn't have a period for 6 years and everyone was just like, you look incredible. I thought you were going to be fat forever. There's a lot of glorification and encouragement of this addiction. So I wanted to be able to look at the nuance of this as deeply as I could in a 90-minute play and keep it dramatically interesting and all of those things. But yeah.
And I think that that's where perhaps you creating it responsibly is part and parcel of creating it authentically, because it is so layered, because it manifests differently in each of these four people within the family. And honestly, as part of society, right? Like the, you know, her father and the husband, Peter, and his expectations. It's also that, not that he's a bad guy, right? It's that society has taught him this is what's attractive or what I'm supposed to think is attractive. Therefore, I'm going to mold my wife to this. You know, to this structure, and then my wife is going to mold my daughter to this structure. It's really, it's all intertwined. It's all intertwined.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, that was something that was really pivotal for a long time. Like that, it was the character of the mother, gets a lot of flack. A lot of people, get very angry and call her all sorts of names after the play. And I just was like, you know, that it was really struggling with like, well, this woman is, she's sick too. She's got a lot going on too. And we need to really look at that. I think a lot of it is also that we just expect so much from mothers in general. And we're a lot harder on them than on fathers. And I found that no matter how overt, I mean, there was a lot, there's a line in the play where Peter directly says to Joan, is that what you wore to work today? And she says, yeah, why? And it looks a little tight. And I remember being told like, oh, that line's going too far. I was like, it's not. Because the thing is, what's interesting is Joan does a tiny little misstep and the audience is like, oh my God, Peter can say some really, you know, he can actively like take food away from his wife and the audience won't bat an eye, because we are much more forgiving of fathers in general. And Rachel, to a degree, has that. She is very loving of her father. She doesn't really see the ways in which he expects her to parent him and brings her into the middle of their marriage and crosses a lot of boundaries, which makes her a parentified child. Yes. And I think she really does trust and love her father. And it's this shock at the end of the play when she kind of comes full circle and realizes, like, oh, wait, you've been like, okay, you have, you're so good with
you've
me,
been part
but
of
you're
the
in,
problem
yeah, you're
all
a
along.
Huge part of the problem because you're enabling mom. And you also, as my father, and looking at, you know, what you find attractive, you're modeling for me what it means to be an attractive woman to men. Men say this sometimes, you know, like certain things won't hit them until they think of, oh, well, I have a daughter. And you know, that's like something that comes often. Well, this person is someone's daughter.
Yes.
It's like, okay. But you know what? We're still human beings. And you cannot, it doesn't cut it anymore to treat your daughter and your wife differently, because your daughter one day is going to grow up and realize, like, and she's going to be affected by the standards you hold your wife to.
The play really revolves around the mother-daughter relationship mm-hmm. between Joan, the mother, and Rachel, the daughter. And it's interesting because we need to talk about them separately and together.
Yes.
Like, Rachel could have anorexia without a model from her mom.
Absolutely.
Joan could be restrictive and have children without eating mm-hmm. problems. Why was it important for you to show both and how they interact?
Once I decided that Rachel had anorexia, I knew that there had to be another. I just couldn't write a play without looking at the complexities of, you know, there's various kinds of eating disorders in the world. And mm-hmm. I think the way we talk about clean eating, and I've seen it, you know, just discussed, is like, you have so much discipline. It's this thing that is really like, oh, I wish I had your willpower. And orthorexia, which a lot of people are not aware of, I mean, it's the obsession with clean eating to the point where you are afraid of eating anything that veers off of what you deem a safe food. And this mm-hmm. can be really, really intense. And also the thing about it is easily hidden, especially in today's modern society. You can say you're allergic to gluten, you're vegan, you're dairy free, whatever it is, we've normalized this illness. When we were working on it as a cast, a lot of people did not know what the term orthorexia was, and I had to clarify it various times, and people were learning about it. And some people were mm-hmm. and then everyone has the experience of like, oh wait, do I have this actually? Because there are certain foods that I'm pretty afraid of. So I did really want to bring awareness to that in general. And the decision to have it be in this particular family, Joan could not have orthorexia, and Rachel most likely would still end up having an eating disorder, just because of there are so many things for this character that are going on. Like the pressure, mm-hmm. also being the daughter of a first generation immigrant, like there are a lot of pressures that are put on to succeed. You know, Joan does talk about how she did some writing in college, but it's not like, you know, her parents did sacrifice everything to come here and give her this shot, and she had to really make something of herself. And she married a white man who was wealthy, and his family definitely gave him a hard time for marrying her, so she felt like she had to prove herself. And as a Latin woman growing up in this country, she knows that things are going to be really hard for her daughter, and she understands that in a way that her husband does not. And so he doesn't understand why she puts so much pressure on her daughter, but she fully does, because she knows that Rachel's going to experience reality in a very different way than Joan did. And mm-hmm. there's references in the play to, you know, Rachel feeling the sacrifice her mother made as a career woman to carry her, to have this time that she lost out in her career. That was something that was really important to me to acknowledge in the identities of these characters.
Yeah, I mean, that's actually was going to be my next question about like the way you blended this family so specifically of, you know, the white father, the Latina mother, a biological daughter, and an adopted mm-hmm. Latino son. You made a lot of choices that all contribute to the telling of this story.
Well, there's a combination of, you know, reading studies and learning a lot about, okay, what are the typical family models for eating disorder, which kind of ties back to like, okay, well, what's up with, you know, Joan didn't have to have an eating disorder. But why was it important to include this? And I there's actually a family friend who lives in Ecuador and is a therapist. And she was saying how she was working with children's schools, and there was a problem that was coming up where like mothers and fathers would come in and be like, our child isn't eating, you know, she won't eat rice. And the teacher was noticing this and is like, this is a big problem at lunches. And the mothers will be like, well, I tell them, you know, to eat, like, please eat these foods. And then the teacher, the therapist, my mother's friend was like, okay, well, what do you eat? And then the mothers were like, oh, I would never touch that, you know, but I encourage them to. And it's like, and I remember when I heard that comment and I was like, okay, I knew this was in my play for a reason. This comes up. This is something that is often, unfortunately, this is a thing. These words can be very generational. And it's genetics too. Like I know that I've encountered my own mother blaming herself, and I'll just be like, you know what, mom, like there's just a certain, like, it's in our blood, it's in our DNA, just like just like anxiety and depression is. There's, it's just the way the cookie crumbles. But back to,
which also society is very new at acknowledging how in our DNA anxiety and depression is, like mental illness, it being treated as illness is still so new. And then you get into the subsets, like you said, of addiction disorders and eating disorders not being a choice. Yeah. So everyone has to really reconceptualize the way we think
Absolutely.
About these issues.
I mean, the DSM for a long time described anorexia as the refusal to eat food, which is like, okay, well, interesting, because you're literally just in this is mental health. You're saying that it's a choice. But back to the question of, you know, the family dynamics and the way they were, that it is very specific in this play. And, you know, one of the reasons is casting. You know, I am Hispanic, and I initially wrote the play just sort of like I wanted colorblind casting the way Hamilton did. I think that's the way of the future. And I think it's a really great thing. And it was really exciting as a Latin actor to see, like, oh, wait, I could play like Eliza Hamilton. Like that's pretty cool to know that could happen. But it became very clear to me, you know, casting directors see five characters and they're going to assume a certain ethnicity. So I was like, okay, well now I really need to work this into my play. I am a first generation immigrant. So my parents are both born and raised in Ecuador, moved here. They were very young. My mother was 19 when she got married, 22 when she had me. Wow. And I have definitely felt the pressures of assimilation in a lot of ways, and especially within the past year have been unpacking how assimilation in and of itself is a very strong form of racism. It's not good. Growing up in America and England, I also grew up in England, did for me in ways of like, okay, how can I blend in? How can I hide from the sun? Can I do these things? And what is the fitting in? So that has been, and something that is, there's a lot of pressure put on too, and a lot of praise if you are Latin, at least in my experiences. If you're going to be with a, you know, white, blue-eyed man, you kind of have won the lottery.
My last question solely for you, Domenica, is that you played Rachel in that run. And I'm wondering, you know, as you said in the beginning, that this is something – as a person in the world you deal with every single day. So how did you cope with getting inside of that character, you know, every single performance over and over again? What, if anything, did you learn about your own eating disorder by playing her? How did you keep yourself safe?
Thank you. That's a great question. One I haven't been asked, and I'm really grateful to be asked, because it was definitely a process. I learned a lot from Rachel that I was not expecting to. Something that Rachel really teaches me, and still honestly to this day inspires me in, is the anger she expresses at her family at the end. I think, as is common of people who suffer with eating disorders, I am a very repentant perfectionist and a people pleaser. And I don't know that I've ever let it rip like that. I mean, Rachel goes into a rage blackout. She figures things out and she just says she sees everything clearly and she knows she has to get out of here. And that was really, I mean, when the run of the play ended and we got an extension, so that was a gift for me, but I thought as a writer, I was going to be like, my baby, I don't know what, like, what am I doing with myself? But actually it was like my body was mourning getting to perform Rachel, getting to get that angry 8 times a week and have that expression was so important and cathartic and healing for me. And then keeping myself safe as someone who has struggled with disordered eating, it was hard. I put a note in the play that's very important to me that says, you know, the actresses playing Joan and Rachel should never feel any pressure to maintain a certain weight to play these roles, because I know for myself, when I had amenorrhea and I was struggling to figure out what was going on and turning to doctors for every answer, I was not thin. I weighed at least 20 pounds more than I do now. And doctors were just like, oh, you're probably stressed. Huh. You're fine. And I even told them, my mother thinks I'm under eating. Like, this is what's going on. Like, they had the key. And they just were like, no, you're fine. You're fine. You're fine. And it wasn't until I came. Because the thing is, weight loss is, you can have, it, weight has nothing to do with an eating disorder. I mean, absolutely nothing. And doctors really need to catch up to that.
Yes.
I had such wonderful support from my cast. I'm really lucky to have a very supportive family. And I think just really having a post-show thing for me, which was often, people in the theater would come up to me, like audience members, be like, it's so good to see you eating. Because always the actress who played Joan and I would afterwards like go and eat food together and just have that that ritual of doing that. And actually during the play, I made sure to eat more than I had in a long time because I was expending a lot of energy doing this performance and just trying to stay on top of things. And knowing that if there was any thing I feel internally that are my own insecurities, I can channel them into Rachel. I can let all of that go because, of course, I still have that. It's still present in me. By having played Rachel and intentionally kind of milking those moments, I can notice them within myself and be like, when they arise and be like, okay, that's an unhealthy part of myself talking. Let me look at that. Let me journal about that. Let me talk to my therapist about that. Let me really be honest about this when it comes. Like, I think playing Rachel helped me notice when that was going on more. So it was really a healing experience.
Well, that's amazing. I mean, we've talked, I feel like rage is becoming a theme on this podcast, but we talk a lot about rage and the necessity of it, to that it's not the same as anger, that it is productive anger. It is anger focused at something. And I also,
And we don't experience women. We don't let women experience rage nearly enough.
Absolutely.
We accept it from men. And there's a great podcast where I heard it was the Kavanaugh hearings, which were happening at the time that I did one of my first readings of Rinse Repeat. And they very much informed the play, especially the ending, shifting the blame, not blame, but just shifting responsibility from Joan to Peter. I was like, wait, I can't write a play about eating disorders that blames women. But it's interesting to look at those hearings and how, like, he got to be very angry and was rewarded with a seat on the Supreme Court as a result. And whereas Dr. Blasey Ford, who was the person who had actually, in my opinion, been wronged, could not be angry. She had to be calm and even-tempered in order to be listened to. And that's the dichotomy. That's what happens. Women, if we are rageful, we are dismissed. We're too emotional. Whereas men are like strong and righteous when they express their rage.
But the expression piece is so important. I've been doing some work. I don't know if anyone out there has heard of the Hoffman Institute, but look it up.
Yes,
it's phenomenal.
My father went there.
Okay, so the Hoffman Institute is amazing. And kind of like, it's a lot about internal investigation of patterns of behavior. And one of the things that they have you focus on, which I feel like in society we do not, is we focus on awareness and then we focus on changing it. Like, oh, now I know it's here, so now I can change it. But what we really need to do is that in-between step of the expression. We are not expressing and getting it out. And so what you're describing is that you were able to express through the play, which is so powerful.
Praised by Lin-Manuel Miranda as the future of musical theater, SUFF's creator Shayna Taub makes Broadway history as only the second woman to write the book, music, lyrics, and star in her own original new musical. Don't miss the much-anticipated Broadway debut of the singular artist that Forbes calls visionary and Billboard anoints as one of the most inventive voices in musical theater. SUFF's The Original New Musical from Shayna Taub is now playing on Broadway at the Music Box Theater Get your tickets today at SuffsMusical.com. The Outsiders on Broadway tells the story of finding where you belong when the world refuses to accept you. Based on Essie Hinton's beloved novel, featuring new music from Jamestown Revival and Justin Levine, and directed by Danya Taymor, Entertainment Weekly says that, with brilliant staging and some of the most captivating stage fighting currently on Broadway, The Outsiders has the power to inspire an entire generation. Get your tickets today at OutsidersMusical.com.
And so now that we're all going to express together, I want to welcome in our experts. First, I want to welcome Dr. Maylin Reyes-Rodriguez, who is an associate clinical professor at the Center of Excellence for Eating Disorders in the Department of Psychiatry at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. She is a licensed clinical psychologist with experience treating patients with eating disorders. Her research focuses on developing culturally appropriate interventions for Latinas with eating disorders, specifically methods that appropriately integrate family members. She's a columnist for La Noticia and the editor-in-chief of Puerto Rican Journal of Psychology. Welcome, Maylin.
Thank you. Thank you for the invitation, Rudy. And Dominique, I think that you did a great job presenting the struggling of eating disorder in Latina. I think that when I was reading through the play, I was like remembering some of my cases and identifying the stigma of having an eating disorder for Latinos. We know about the stigma about having mental health issue in the Latino population. However, what I found with Latinos is that the stigma of having an eating disorder is greater than having, for example, depression and anxiety. And it's because I think in some way that I am having an eating disorder and a disorder that doesn't belong to me because I am not a white. So historically, we have been associated the eating disorder to white females. And then as a Latina, struggling with an eating disorder, it's like I am suffering for something that is not from part of my ethnicity. So that increased a lot the stigma of having an eating disorder. And the other piece that for me was amazing to see in the play was the integration of the family. Is in some way the importance of engaging the family into the treatment because everybody is affecting. It's not only the patient who is affecting by the eating disorder, but this is something that the entire family is affected by the eating disorder. So if we wanted to provide an environment that can help the patient to heal, we have to integrate the family if it is possible. Part of my research working with Latinas is when we can include a family member, help to engage the patient into treatment and also retain the patient into treatment, because that is another issue that we have with Latinas, that it is hard to engage on treatment, but also they tend to abandon the treatment pretty quickly. She has something, but it was so hard to put the name that was an eating disorder.
Right. I think the word anorexia actually only appears one time in the entire play.
Yes.
So, yeah, that's very powerful. Well, Maylin, we're going to get into all of that. I'm so excited to have you here. I want to introduce our listeners to our other expert, Joanna Kendell. Joanna is the founder and CEO of the Alliance for Eating Disorders Awareness, which was founded in the year 2000. She is the immediate past president of the board of directors for the Eating Disorders Coalition. And in addition to leading a support group and mentoring those with eating disorders, Joanna has met with members of Congress as a part of her advocacy and was part of the first ever Eating Disorders Roundtable at the White House. She is also the author of a book about her own struggle with an eating disorder. Welcome, Joanna.
Thank you so much, Ruthie. And thank you all so much for this opportunity. And, you know, I definitely echo what was said. The play is exceptional. It's really wonderful whenever there's opportunities to, you know, create much needed conversations and smash the stigma surrounding mental illness. I think what was so beautiful that you said earlier is that there's so much misinformation surrounding eating disorders, that they're a disorder of choice, of vanity, where we know that they are serious mental illness. It was an incredible moment when Health and Human Services actually classified eating disorders as serious mental illness because, like you and like many of us that have experienced eating disorders, you know, this is not something where I looked out the window and I said, you know, oh, it's a beautiful day in South Florida today. I think I'm going to have anorexia nervosa now. Like, that was never part of my journey nor anyone else's journey, I can say. You know, we know that there's this perfect storm that comes together of, you know, genetics. We know that genetics play a key role in the development of eating disorders. They run in families. We know that there's temperament traits. There's the coexisting of comorbid mental illness such as depression and anxiety. We know that anxiety is typically always present before the development of an eating disorder. And it's really interesting to see who eating disorders typically affect. They're, you know, as you said so beautifully before, it's individuals that are perfectionistic and people pleasers and type AAA personalities. You know, I one of the things that is just like sort of echoes in my head a lot is, you know, I was the kid that my parents never had to be concerned about. Like, I was the good kid, you know, and again, it was, you know, for me, it was really classifying it by saying, you know, that quote, the path to hell is filled with good intentions. I thought that I was on this journey of bettering myself. I was a professional ballet dancer. You can add that into that perfect storm. We know that there's that, you know, that negative energy balance that gears genetics that launches the development of the eating disorder. And before you know it, something that I thought, oh, you know, like, I'm doing this to be a better dancer, to get a part. I was engaged in a fight that nearly almost, you know, cost me my life, and that affect 29 million Americans across the country. That's 9% of the U.S. population will experience some type of an eating disorder in their lifetime. Every 52 minutes, someone dies as a direct result of their eating disorder in this country. It costs the U.S. $64 billion a year in resources. It has huge economic burdens on our country, and yet, what I find myself to be so passionate about is creating opportunities for education, for intervention, and for access to care. Because unfortunately, even though it has the second highest lethality rate of all psychiatric disorders, only 1/3 of individuals that are experiencing eating disorders will ever get access to care. You know, and so for me, that was really why I think I connected, you know, so beautifully with the play. Something that I really also enjoyed is that you didn't sensationalize the eating disorder. You didn't talk about specific numbers or specific rituals. I'm confident that there were people that came to see the show and hopefully will come and see the show again or listen to this conversation that, you know, might have experienced their life, you know, experiencing orthorexic, you know, behaviors, and in that guise of I'm doing this to be healthy and I'm doing this to be clean. And yet, unfortunately, what's happened is the diet industry has commandeered a lot of ways that people have to eat for medical conditions. For example, eating sugar-free because of their diabetes, eating gluten-free because of their celiac. Fortunately, the diet industry has hijacked these ways and said, hey, this is a way to insert, you know, lose weight, do this. So
right. And that there are certain legitimate medical conditions that require this. You know, it's the appropriation of it onto people without a diagnosis like that becomes problematic. I mean, Joanna, you fit right in on this podcast because you just whipped out all the statistics that I had turned my notes to. So thank you for that, because I really do want to give some context as to how prevalent this is, how lethal it is, how important it is. And, you know, in talking about the layers of everything that's going on in the play, one of the lines that really stuck with me was when Rachel is yelling at herself and trying to get herself to eat, and she's going, it's just food. That's all. It is just food. But that clearly doesn't cover it. You know, it's like, so I want to go, I have different questions for each of you related to this. Domenica, what is food in Rachel's mind? Because it's clearly not just food.
No, it's not. And I think this is something that's been parroted at her or told to her or something she knows that her mother feels, and something she, you know, and her mother has left her alone and she has to prove that she can do this because in Joan's eyes, it's just food. Sit down and eat lunch. Why can't you just do that? But it's not about the food. It's really not. And that's something that doesn't make sense to a lot of people, but there is so much more going on. And it's what the food represents. And I do think a big part of it is control. When you have to, you know, especially if you are Rachel, if you're someone who knows, and yeah, her mother did biologically carry her mother who doesn't have a period, who has a pretty bad eating disorder. Like, what did it take for Joan to get pregnant? A lot, clearly. And she didn't choose, when she had another mm-hmm. child, she adopted that child because she was not going to get pregnant again. So add that to the pressure that was also put on Rachel, like, be worth the sacrifice my body made, my body that really struggles to function hormonally, because I, Domenica, mm-hmm. know what that is. When your body won't function hormonally because of an eating disorder, it is really hard to get that period back. It took me 6 years. And there is that much pressure put on you. There's a part of you that's going to be exploding inside. There's a part of you that's just going to be like, I can't do this anymore. And I think Rachel's way of saying that without saying it was her disease and was her illness. And like,
right.
with food, you're controlling everything. So it makes sense to then control the one thing that you can, because so many other things are outside of her control. She's trying to control the fact that she wants to be a writer. She can't. She wants to be a writer. It's still living inside there. She can't squash that. But she can not eat or eat. She can do that. If she doesn't eat the food, she's disappointing everyone in her life. And if she does eat the food, she's disappointing herself because she's pretending that things are fine when they're really not. So it's very, very complicated.
Absolutely. And so Maylin, knowing that it's really not, it's about so many more things than the food, than the act of eating. And yet, you know, part of the treatment plan for people with eating disorders is getting you to eat, is meeting with a dietitian. Is that how we should be treating things if it's so often about much bigger ideas?
Yeah, and it is true that it's not only about food. I think that there is many layers when we are working with a patient, especially with anorexia nervosa. And yes, it is tricky because we have to help the patient to restore their weight because we have those concerns about how medically stable is the patient to mm-hmm. do the treatment, and also because it's affecting their cognitions and how they can receive and accept the treatment. So it is hard for the patient to go into the goal of weight restoration. So it's a combination of, we know that it's hard, and how we can provide the emotional support. And when I was reading that line specifically, I was remember many parents asking the same to the patient. It's just food. You just need to eat. And how complicated it is to explain to parents that it's more than that. And how they can provide the support that they need during the treatment process.
Absolutely. Joanna, did you want to add about, you know, just the conception about, is this about food? Is this not about food? Is it both?
So yeah, absolutely. So it's definitely about both. It has to be about both because you need food to live. And it's really difficult because, you know, with recovery, you know, from, for example, substance use disorder or drug addiction, you can abstain from your drug of choice, quote unquote. When you're experiencing an eating disorder, recovering from an eating disorder, you cannot abstain from food. It's a right. different moderative, you know, recovery where you need it to survive. Mm-hmm. You know, we have to remember that eating disorders are maladaptive coping mechanisms. It's how people maladaptively cope with depression, anxiety, trauma, transgenerational trauma, other concurrent personality disorders, that's how they live. And the mechanism is whether it's restricting, binging, and purging, compulsively overeating, clean eating. And we also have to remember, like, the reason why it's so important to really normalize nutrition is because it doesn't matter what kind of eating disorder you're experiencing, whether you're restricting or actively binging, you still have a malnourished brain. And you really cannot do much work unless you have that amelioration of the malnutrition. Managed care companies are looking at straight vitals, or looking at weights, which, of course, like has been said many times, like, okay, let's definitely look beyond the weight. They're looking at labs. Yes. And the things about eating disorders is you could be actually dying and have perfectly fine labs. We have to remember that labs are gross measures, right? They're not specific. So again, we need to be looking beyond that. And someone needs to be, you know, like, nourished. They need to have, like, you know, an active brain to start working on the underpinnings, the bottom of the iceberg, because the eating disorder really just is the top. And so that's why I think for so much of this conversation, it's been, this is not about the food. Well, yes, it is. And we need to be nourished in order to deal with everything that's underneath, because if you just focus on re-nourishing, you're just going to have that revolving door, because it's not about that.
Right. But you also can't address the thing it is about without having the nourishment.
Exactly.
That makes perfect sense. Mm-hmm. I also want to just put out there for the record, you know, Domenica said it earlier, that there is a spectrum of eating disorders and a spectrum of what people look like who have and struggle with eating disorders. This is not just the 85-pound white woman going in, you know, having heart problems. And, you know, I remember when I was in school being taught what this is. You should be looking out for people who are always cold. You should be looking out for people who are tired. You should be looking out if your friend is growing more hair, you know, all of these things. And not that those are not symptoms. It's just that those aren't the only symptoms. That is not the only picture of this. You can be what society considers fat and have an eating disorder. You can be what society considers fat and have anorexia as your eating disorder. Yes. It's not just that, oh, skinny people are anorexic and fat people are bingers. You know, this affects. And the research that I did and that the professionals have done, I'm sure Maylin will echo this, that this affects people of all ages, of all ethnicities, of all genders. We are a bunch of women in this room talking about this, but this is by no means a women-only issue. It affects men, non-binary. And so I just want to put that out there and say that it might not look what you think it looks like. It is still a problem. And so knowing that, I am curious whether you're thinking something might be wrong with yourself or whether you are concerned about someone you love, what are the signs that we should be looking for?
The other issue is how we can raise the awareness on providers, because sometimes they just look into some specific stereotype and not asking or assessing the eating disorder or referring the patient for a further evaluation because they don't fit into the stereotype. I remember doing an interview with a Latina, and she mentioned about having three different encounters with different providers and saying, I think that I have bulimia. And they didn't do anything. No refer, no further question. And she was struggling with bulimia. So I think that is raising the awareness for patients, family, but also for providers.
Yes, I learned that as of 2016, the Association of American Medical Colleges found out that only 74% of schools that are in that association cover eating disorders in any way. So that still leaves 26% who don't talk about it at all, and 74% who we don't really know to what degree They talk about it and the accuracy of that information.
So I will tell you across the board, it's actually less than 20% across the board.
Oh, wow.
For all healthcare providers, nurses, doctors, dentists, they are not given access to that education. And, you know, I've worked very closely with the American Medical Association, and I find myself getting very frustrated. It's like, well, doctors should know. One of the things that we're doing at the Alliance is working with residency programs, specifically around residential, like doing like testing, because we know, unfortunately, they teach for tests. And it's also making sure that the information that they're given is accurate. Like what Maylin said is, you know, give our primary care providers with these tools, but also letting people know that are out there, that there are places where you can get really great information. Like at the Alliance, for example, we have the largest inclusive referral database for all levels of care for individuals seeking help for eating disorders, from therapists to dietitians, all the way up to acute medical stabilization. We also have free weekly virtual support groups that are led by clinicians that are attended by people in all 50 states around the country and 43 wow. different countries around the world. You don't have to go through this alone. And the one thing that I'm so grateful for this play and so grateful for you, Domenica, is that there's people out there that have walked the walk and that are on the other side. And, you know, whether you describe if you prescribe to the word recovered, that's where I landed, and it's a personal choice, or in recovery or recovering or in remission, whatever word works for you. If you are sitting there listening to this podcast, and this is why I'm so damn grateful for the awareness that this play has brought, is that please know that you are not alone. Please know that there is help, that there is hope, that people live beyond their eating disorders. And specifically, if you are a loved one, I think that, you know, unfortunately, we're given this misnomer that once you have an eating disorder, you will be struggling at that level for the rest of your life. That is not the case. Now, I will tell you, intervention is necessary. Access to care is important. This is not something that you can just will away. Like, you can't will away a broken bone. You cannot will away your eating disorder. You deserve access to care. In my opinion, treatment cannot be a luxury. It's a necessity, because just like you can't stabilize your blood sugars if you have diabetes, you cannot just fix the eating disorder. Like, you can't fix anxiety and depression.
I'm really grateful that you said that, Joanna, because I know for myself, like, my mother had an eating disorder for at least a decade of my life. And she would say, honestly, longer, because there was a period where she thought she was recovered, but she was just in that clean eating little bucket of just doing lots of cleanses and things. But now my mother has this incredible relationship with food, and it's so beautiful to see. And it inspires me so much to know that it is really possible to get to that place and to believe in that, and to also have compassion for yourself if you're not there yet. If you're not there yet, like, that doesn't mean that you're bad. That doesn't mean, like, you're doing the best that you can, and you deserve love, and you deserve all of these things. It is a journey. It can be a lifelong journey, but it's one that is worth taking and not giving up.
I can't agree more. Like, I say this all the time to people, is that you don't recover to utopia, you recover to life. And life has good moments and they have bad moments. And I will tell you, recovery is absolutely not sunshine, bunnies and rainbows, you know? And I think that for so long, I avoided recovery because it was the complete opposite from the hell that I was in, you know? And so know that, you know, that, yeah, it's, you're going to, you know, are you going to have bad body image days? Mm-hmm. Yeah, because you're human, and humans have that. But the difference is, like, now, which I'm sure you can relate to, is there's moments where, you know, I wake up in the morning and I look in the mirror and I'm like, oh, wow. And the difference is that I'll just put on more comfortable clothes and I'll get on with my life. As when I was in the grips of my eating disorder, I would punish myself. I would go back to bed. I couldn't do life. And so it's not going to be perfect. It's going to be messy and it's going to be unbelievable. But no matter where you are, know that that it does get better.
Something that you mentioned, Joanna, about access to treatment, that's where the real discrepancy lies. The discrepancy doesn't lie in the rates of eating disorders between populations and demographics. The discrepancy lies within access. I did want to rewind a little bit, though, because as we're saying that, like, labs can be, you know, not a great picture, the number on the scale is not a great indicator, just the self-reporting of the behavior, is that what we should be looking at in ourselves and the people we love as the indicator that there is a problem? What is the criterion that is accurate and up to date?
I think that always I look into the extreme, right? When we are moving into any kind of extreme, there is a problem. I think that having a balance, and if you don't feel comfortable with your eating pattern or with your self-esteem, with your body image, that is the time that you can seek help. We don't have to wait until having a full diagnostic of eating disorder to seek professional help. I have had in the past parents reaching me to provide some kind of preventing treatment for their daughter because she was like struggling with some kind of body image issue. And I think that just by having that approach from the beginning, when we can see adolescent having issue with the body image issue, we can prevent to develop an eating disorder. So I think that anytime that you don't feel comfortable with whatever is going on in your life, or you don't feel good about your emotions, your feelings, your behavior, that is the time that you can seek professional help. I know that for specifically for the Latino population, it's hard because there is the stigma. They don't want to feel that they are crazy, right? It's like, I am not loco. So I think that we need to do more in terms of education, that we all can have emotional issue and it is okay to seek professional help.
I think something that's also important is, Maylin, you talked about that woman who was bulimic and yet nobody intervened. I think listening to people in our lives is really important. When I was in school second year, I went to Tisch, and we had to do these poetry projects where we chose a topic and we came up with like three pieces that focus on the topic. And I did mine on eating disorders, and it was like, absolutely a cry for help. Like, it was complete. I mean, I was not doing well. That's when finally doctors started running real tests, because I met their criteria of what an eating disorder looked like a year after I'd gone to them for help. So at this point, it wasn't very helpful. Wow. Because I was deep in it. And I had the hormones of a woman going through menopause, and I was 19 years old. And I did this performance, and I did it in front of everyone. And it was basically me saying, I need help. And, you know, my teachers were just very praiseworthy of the acting. And I remember in my panel afterwards, one of the movement teachers was like, I'm concerned. I'm concerned, and I think you need to get help. And I remember one of my other acting teachers literally saying, like, you know, I don't really know about that, but your performance was really great. There was just this complete like sidestepping. And I know that the high school I went to in England, it was like an all-girls school, and there were eating disorders everywhere. I mean, it was the second best private girls school. I mean, talk about privilege. It was a great school. And we were performing at just absurd. The standards were ridiculous. 95% of grades were all A's for students. And the school never, I mean, there were eating disorders everywhere, and the school just, they didn't care, because as long as we were performing well. What are their energy levels, I think, would be something that's really important. Like, I know that when my eating disorder was really bad, I was falling asleep all the time. I was really struggling to stay awake, and also struggling to fall asleep. Like, just, you know, as Joanna said so powerfully, like, the brain neurons aren't working. There are a lot of signs that, you know, can show you beyond how somebody looks. Like, and you can still have somebody achieving surface level, but they may be just not themselves. I think when someone is just completely withdrawn from life, that's a sign that they're not fully there. If you notice a loved one shifting, and be concerned, you know, you may still be getting the results from your worker, from your like student, whatever it is. I mean, care about them on a human level. And if somebody, like the example Maylin gave, is, you know, asking for help, like, dear God, like, please pay attention.
When you hear that, what is the thing to say? What is the helpful way to help someone get support?
Yeah, I think such a great question. I think something to remember is when you're talking to someone that you have concerns over or concerns with is using I statements. You know, I'm concerned, I've noticed, I care, I love you, I can help whatever you need. The more that you attack, the more that the walls are going to go up. And I mean, that was definitely my experience of people, you know, out of love, caring, and compassion, you know, saying like, you're so insert word, you're so this, you're so that. My eating disorder like threw that wall up faster than I could blink. And we have to remember that, you know, the person that's experiencing the eating disorder probably has this love-hate relationship with their eating disorder. It's the thing that's keeping them afloat. And yet it's the thing that's probably making them sink at the same time. And so if you approach a loved one, and this is something that I work with parents across the country, and they'll ask me loved ones, so they'll say, you know, what was something that someone could have said to you, your parents, your loved ones, your, you know, spouse, insert whatever. And I always come to this is, you know, say, I love you and I'm really concerned. And I'm really sorry that you're going through this, because that again puts the onus on the fact that this is not a disorder of choice. An eating disorder happens to you. It's not the opposite. And so, mm-hmm. you know, by turning around and saying, and imagining, if you will, we have an amazing member of our organization who equates eating disorders to brain cancer, because it actually has a whole lot of similarities between
yes.
it. And if someone was going through cancer, you wouldn't be like, you're crazy, mm-hmm. like you need to do this.
If they were in remission and the cancer came back, you wouldn't say, oh, it's all your fault, you didn't XYZ.
I think that because it's above the neck, there's this assumption that we should be able to control it. And if you are a friend of someone that has a child with an eating disorder, support them in the same way that you would if their child had cancer. Because I will tell you, in some instances, the journey to recovery from an eating disorder is that there's no one way, right way, direct way. So oftentimes I will hear in loved ones support group is that I sometimes wish that they had a physical only disorder, because then I would know that I would do X amount of like chemo, X amount of radiation, or this medicine, and then it would hopefully be done. And with eating
right,
disorders, you have no idea.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, we've already talked about so much, and I feel like the last two things I want to wrap up on, we could talk about for an hour each, but we will give them a little bit of attention. And the first thing is just about diet culture in general, because as we've been talking, you know, we've touched on anorexia nervosa, bulimia nervosa, binge eating disorder, and orthorexia. And I say this because those are four distinct labeled conditions. There is a spectrum between all of it. The biggest environmental factor is this sociocultural aggrandizement of thinness. And is there any, I guess the first question is clinical, and maybe it's just a yes or no answer. Maylin, is there any type of disciplined eating, restrictive eating, watching what you're eating that is healthy? Or is it all just symptomatic and related to unhealthy eating?
Yeah, usually we don't recommend any kind of diet. I think that we need to learn how to eat in a balanced way. Food mm-hmm. is just food, and you can eat whatever you wanted to eat. If it is in moderation with the frequency, food portion, but food is a medicine for our body. Mm-hmm. So I think that diet is a risk factor for eating disorder. We need to stay away from dieting behavior. And I know that is so hard in this society that glorify the dieting behavior. But I think that is the message. Don't engage in any kind of diet behavior.
Yeah. And I also think, you know, it's interesting. We talked about beauty ideals in the very first episode of this podcast ever. And I did a paper on this in college about how you know, when we were less technologically linked globally, there were different beauty ideals all over the world. And certainly, particularly in Latinx countries, the voluptuous and curvy body was really coveted. And now we've gone, you know, it's converged to a single ideal body type, and that single ideal body type is thinner and thinner and thinner. So it also relates, you know, to media and to beauty ideals. And I guess, you know, how is the way that we can challenge diet culture?
First and foremost, one of the things that I know that we've seen even at the Alliance, specifically over the last decade, is the influence of social media specifically as compared to like the mass media. We know factually through research that social media has even more negative implications on body image, on the effects of the development of an eating disorder, because number one, you're surrounded by it all the time. I mean, I can fully share that I am the person that the first thing that I do when I wake up in the morning is check my phone. The last thing that I do before I go to bed is check my phone. You know,
right.
Also, we also believe that since so much of so many of the people that we follow on the social channels are people that we know, we view that as more credible sources. But also at the same time, we're not taking into play how many filters have been put in, how many pictures were taken to post that one picture. You take 40 pictures to show one. And in a sense, we are comparing our everyday to the highlight reel of someone else, right? That's there. So what I like to say to people all the time is, you know, be very mindful of your feed, curate your feed, watch who you follow. You know, you're allowed to mute people. You're allowed to disengage from people. You're allowed to be very mindful. See how you feel after you've been on those social channels. If you're feeling crappy about yourself, then maybe you need to be taking a look at who you're following, what messages you're consuming. And yeah, I mean, going back to your question about the diet industry, I mean, it's not a, you know, $60 billion industry for no reason. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, you know, our world is dripping in diet culture, in weight stigma, in fat phobia, because realistically, there is no such thing as good food or bad foods. Food doesn't have value. It's food. I come from a health at every size perspective that all foods fit, you know, and when we start to put restrictions, that's when we allow this idea of like binge behavior to come in. The number one behavior that leads to binging is restricting. We know that. And when you tell someone that they can't have it, it starts to put the narrative in their mind that they need to have it. I'm just like when you tell a kid not to do something, it's the number one thing that they will do, you know, and so I would say be very mindful of the media you consume. Also, when you see something that's not right, that doesn't align with your values, use your voice. And on the flip side, when you find something that works really well, also utilize your voice. We do a much better job at when things are not good at using our voice, but we don't necessarily lift up the things that are working. You know, there's this really great, I know that the Dove campaign has done a beautiful job over the years. They have a really great selfie video that just came out recently. And I, you know, I was like, I'm so happy that that's there. And so I sent a message to Dove. Like I Googled like the people and I sent and I said, thank you. And I got an email back saying it means a lot to hear. So when you see things that are, you know, that are going well, when you see people that are in all shapes and sizes that are, you know, that are out there using their voice, praise them. You know, curating your feed, watching what you consume as far as like media and messaging, and follow people that fill your cup, lift you up. That's
beautiful
important
advice.
Use your tweets positively. There's a study from 2011 that said by age 6, girls start to express concern about their own weight or shape, and 40 to 60% of girls age 6 to 12 are concerned about their weight. Of American elementary school girls who read magazines, 69% say that pictures influence their concept of the ideal body weight, and 47% say that pictures make them want to lose weight.
I'm about to give people two things to not do on the other side of this. I have to say, like, it's very, very, very simple, and it's so important. Like, please don't comment on the way that anybody looks. Just please stop. Like, it's so easy to do. We have no idea what that means. If you tell someone like, oh my God, you've lost weight, you look great, you don't know what that's going to do to them. You also don't know what's going on. They might have really bad anxiety. They might have an eating disorder that you are unknowingly encouraging. They may be dealing with grief. They may be going through whatever it is. And if somebody has gained or whatever it is, just keep it to yourself. Please, I think that if everyone practiced that, like, it really is just, it's none of our business, frankly, at the end of the day. Again, unless you're a therapist treating someone and you've noticed something, like, and you're a professional, like, otherwise, just, there's no need. Like Madeline said so beautifully, like, finding ways to eat everything in moderation is really great, and demonizing any food group, just like there are some people who need less sugar to thrive mentally. You don't know how Oreos are going to affect someone. If they negatively affect you, that's cool. That's fine. They might affect that other person really well. So just don't label foods a certain way.
Maylin, Inge, what do you want to see happen?
I want to see more awareness about eating disorder across ethnicity, race groups. I wanted to see culturally sensitive treatment for Latino population, and I wanted to see access mm-hmm. to treatment. Eating disorder treatment are very expensive, and especially when we are talking about Latino population, sometimes they don't have health insurance, and because of that, that is a huge barrier to get access to treatment. So I think that we need to do more to provide more access to treatment.
Yeah. And then Joanna, to kind of round out that argument, what are the policies that we should be supporting to increase access, to get health insurance to change? What are the what is the legislation that is perhaps up in Washington that we should be paying attention to?
Sure, absolutely. So we have two pieces of legislation currently on the Hill. One is the Nutrition Care Act. So unfortunately, medical nutrition therapy is not covered by insurance in the care of eating disorders. They cover it for diabetes and end-stage renal failure. And trying to recover from an eating disorder without access to a dietitian that specializes in the treatment of eating disorders is like trying to drive a car with three tires and not the fourth. And so what we see all the time is that you know, people will do this revolving door of treatment because they don't have access to a dietitian. So what the Nutrition Care Act, which is a completely bipartisan piece of legislation, does is it mandates medical nutrition therapy in the treatment of eating disorders and Medicare B individuals. And the reason why we started with Medicare is because not only we're seeing eating disorders like in individuals that are over a certain age, also if they're SSDI, if they're Social Security dependent, and I will tell you, 1/4 of individuals that experience eating disorders will end up on disability, just to give you an idea. But also because Medicare is the gold standard of payers of insurance. So once Medicare passes it, then Medicaid comes in, TRICARE, ERISA plans, which is what most businesses have, and then private insurance. We need to have medical nutrition therapy in the treatment of eating disorders. The other important piece of legislation that we have is the SERV Act, which would mandate TRICARE to pay for the treatment of eating disorders. Because currently the way that TRICARE is the insurance for dependents of our loved ones in the armed services. So we're talking about people that give their life for us to have freedom. Currently, wow. The way that TRICARE is written, you can only get access to residential care if you're under the age of 21 years old and experience anorexia nervosa. Wow. Which is such a small part of who experiences eating disorders.
Really, right, tiny slice.
For any information about current legislation, if you go to the Eating Disorders Coalition website, which is eatingdisorderscoalition.org, there's this really great phone to action mechanism on the homepage. And all you have to do is just put in your website, your email, and cell phone number, and you'll get text and emails when all you have to do is just add your name to a piece of legislation, which is so, so important.
And but we'll put that in the show notes as well.
Excellent. And if you are experiencing an eating disorder or have a loved one that has an eating disorder, please know that there is help, that there is hope. Call the Alliance, reach out to the Alliance. Like I said, we have the largest network of providers across the country, and we can we can find clinicians that maybe take your insurance, take Medicare, take Medicaid, that do sliding scale if you don't have insurance. And we also have our free weekly clinician-led support groups. We have 5 currently. We have 2 for individuals that are 18 and older that are experiencing all types of eating disorders. We have 1 that's for the LGBTQ plus pro-recovery community. We have 1 for loved ones, all loved ones of individuals, and 1 just for moms of individuals that are experiencing with eating disorders. So please know that you don't have to walk this journey alone, that there are resources out there. But I just really, before we wrap up, I just really want to thank you, Ruthie, for having this conversation about eating disorders. To you, Dominica, just for writing such an important piece of art. I'm so excited for people to know more about it. By conversations like this and by work that you're doing, more conversations are happening. And so the me's and you's of the world can know that they're not alone, and that despite how terrible it is and despite how daunting recovery can be, that it absolutely does get better.
Yeah. Well, you took the words right out of my mouth. If I can be of any service and contribution, this is it. So we will put resources in the show notes. We will put how you can order and read Domenica's.
It's getting published soon, actually. So there, this will be very timely and well done. And representation matters,
exactly.
Which is why I wrote this play and why the family is Latina family. It's really important for us to see ourselves, and why one of the characters suffering from eating disorder is a woman who's 50 plus. Like that, it's just important for us to know that it affects
absolutely
so many groups of people. And Ruthie, thank you so much for doing this.
Thank you so much, Joanna, Maylin, Domenica, for being here. Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you.
Why We Theater is a product of the Broadway Podcast Network. It's edited and mixed by Derek Gunther. If you like the show, subscribe at bpn.fm/WWT. or Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. And don't forget to leave a review and tell your friends. Our theme music is by Benjamin Velez. Why We Theater is recorded in part on the traditional lands of the Wappinger and Lenape peoples. I acknowledge this land was unjustly taken from them and pay my respect to elders both past and present. Special thanks to Dori Berenstein, Alan Seals, Lee Silverman, Patrick Taylor, Tony Montaneri, Wesley Birdsall, Elena Mayer, and Suzanne Chipkin. For more resources for change, info about our guests, and more, visit us at whywetheater.com.
They say well-behaved women seldom make history. Just ask the Supps. A vibrant and wholly original new musical, Supps celebrates the real women who changed history and their story that is more timely than ever. See the show Variety calls an epic tour de force new musical. Deadline Cheers is a rare Broadway feat and leaves audiences inspired to keep marching. Supps has arrived on Broadway, and not a moment too soon. Get your tickets today at suppsmusical.com. If you love Broadway gossip, you are not going to want to miss any episode of this podcast, Singular Sensation, The Triumph of Broadway. Plenty of dramas unfold on stage, but the best dramas unfold backstage. And there were no bigger dramas than behind the scenes of Sunset Boulevard.
So you were being crucified over here, but
yeah,
not there.
No. No, because I was turning in a performance that would get standing ovations. Excuse me.
So check out my podcast, Singular Sensation, for all the juicy and gory details of Sunset Boulevard.